They both did a good job.
You may proceed.
May it please this honorable court, my name is Eric Korslund. It's a pleasure to be here. I represent the appellant, Mr. Glenn Harris, who was convicted of possession with the intent to distribute second offense cocaine. The narrow issue before the court is, was the evidence sufficient that he possessed the cocaine with the intent to distribute? And although there's a gray area between the intent for personal use and the intent for distribution, I respectfully remind the court there's an enormous legal distinction, consequential distinction. This is an extremely important subject matter, especially from my client's perspective. In this case, to further narrow the issue, Vice Narcotics Detective Montalvo opined that the cocaine was inconsistent with personal use for two reasons. One, that he had two cell phones, one of which was expensive and the other which was cheap. Second, the basis of his opinion was not the amount of money, but the fact that it was stuck in the appellant's pockets. And the appellant had no wallet. Detective Montalvo, in an effort to bolster his opinion, threw out a lot of hypotheticals to the trial court and did not base it on the evidence submitted at trial. For example, he opined that dealers typically break down an amount of cocaine into what's called dime rolls, $10 bags. In this case, there is no baggies, no scales, no indicia of distribution. And as the court is well aware, when it's a circumstantial case, as this case, you look to the conduct and the statements of the accused. No evidence whatsoever to support the opinion on the conduct and the statements of the accused.
Well, let's talk about the...
Go ahead.
Let's talk about what the detective did say. It wasn't that it was a cheaper cell phone. Undoubtedly, it was cheaper. But that wasn't the significance of it. It was a disposable one. And that's the significance, not that it's cheaper.
Yes, sir.
On the street, they call that a burner phone. You finish it up, you throw it away. And it's significant for drug dealers because you don't trace it, obviously, after it's been thrown away. So it's not that it's cheaper. It's that it's disposable.
Correct, Justice. And I agree with that. And to his exact language is, it's common with dealers to have the cheaper phone they can get rid of quickly and easily always pick up another one to avoid detection from law enforcement. So,
in this case, what we've got, three bags of marijuana, one bag of cocaine, all found together in the center console. 2.703 grams cocaine, you know, that's in the... I give you that. That's in the category of could go either way. $316 in various denominations that are folded in such a way that the officer says that it's consistent with drug dealing, which I understand to mean that you can make change easily out of it. And then you have an expert opinion on top of that. And the expert opinion is that taking all the evidence in the totality, it may very well be for personal use, but taking the evidence in totality, my expert opinion is that this was low-level drug distribution. Now, that's what I see in the record. So the question is, if the standard of review is plainly wrong or without evidence to support it on a question of sufficiency, how do you overcome that standard of review?
In your honor, respectfully, to this court, you know, I submit that standard of review does not mean if a vice narcotics expert, properly qualified as an expert, opines that it's inconsistent with personal use, the trial court should not simply rubber stamp that, but
undoubtedly correct. You're absolutely right.
Yes, sir. And if I may comment on a few things.
I'm not sure he did. That's the problem.
Our position is he did, again, with all due respect to the trial court. Because when you look at the basis of the opinion, again, twofold, the cell phones, it's circumstantial. These circumstances must be inconsistent with innocence, consistent with guilt. There's a multitude of reasons why somebody may have two cell phones. Any cell at 7-Eleven sells these. If a man wants to have an affair on his wife, I could go on and on and on. That does not mean to say that the defendant has the burden to put on evidence, which in the Commonwealth suggests that in their argument. But back to the money. $10 rocks, what Montalvo said. The money stuffed in his pockets. The appellant had no wallet. And he had one $10 bill. So his basis of that does not match up. And when you couple that with no indication of distribution, no acts, no statements, and the fact that the expert himself, getting back to your inquiry, Your Honor, the amount, 3.85, is an 8-ball. It's heard of for users to get an 8-ball and use. Here, as Your Honor articulated, 2.7 in one package. So
could be the last package of the night, counsel. This is all that was left.
And Your Honor, that's true. I can't argue that. You know, if somebody has one dime bag, 1/10 of a gram, that same rationale respectfully applies.
But is it your position that cocaine is always packaged exactly according to particular weight standards, and that if you've only got one left, it has to be precisely a dime bag?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. My position is if he had this with the intent to distribute, there would be some indication of distribution, some indicia of distribution. This is a circumstantial case, Judge.
Counsel, the difficulty, and I understand how you didn't argue this to the trial court, the difficulty is that there's significant evidence, there is sufficient evidence that he's a drug dealer. Where the problem is he a marijuana dealer, or is he a cocaine dealer, or is he both? Address that, if you would.
The greater weight of the evidence from my perspective, and as a footnote, I was not trial counsel. I wish I was. The greater weight of the evidence shows that this was for personal use. Including the marijuana.
In separate bags.
Yes, sir.
With all that money folded up in the manner that drug dealers fold it up, with a disposable cell phone, and with three separate bags of marijuana, how is that, argue why that's for personal use.
Well, I'm wrestling with the relation between the marijuana and the cocaine in this case. Let's assume, Your Honor, to answer your inquiry, he possessed the marijuana with the intent to distribute. That doesn't necessarily mean that the trial court should make this leap of faith that he possessed the cocaine with the intent to distribute. And in fact, the detective, he never opined by that. Again, he gave two bases for his opinion. And I'm not urging this court to become experts in narcotics, but to take a closer look at what he's basing his opinion on. It's not the weight, it's not the amount, it's not the packaging, it's not the statements of the accused, it's not the acts of the accused, but he had money in his pocket. How else, and rhetorically, Your Honor, how else is he supposed to keep money in his pocket that would be inconsistent with a drug dealer? To fold it up in certain ways or stick it in different pockets? He's saying the way the money was in his pocket is consistent with the drug dealer, not the amount of money itself. And he gives us hypothetical about how drugs are broken down into dimes. We have no dime bags. We have no bags. We have no scales. So what that means is, and he says that drug deals are done quickly, is that Mr. Harris would have had to eyeball, if you will, amounts of crack cocaine, break it off, and then give it, and then not have the amount of money that's consistent with that particular transaction. It's based on surmise, it's based on speculation in this case, that he possessed these drugs with the intent to distribute.
It seems to me that you're asking us to re-weigh the evidence, in particular, re-weigh the expert's opinion that this was inconsistent with personal use. And we can't really do that. So the trial judge made that determination. And it's obvious that the trial judge accepted and placed weight on the police officer's expert opinion. So that's the record in front of us. We go back to Justice Lemon's questions. How can we say it was plainly wrong without evidence to support it? Because that testimony's there. It's in the record. It's not been objected to.
Yes, sir.
Its admissibility is not in front of us.
Your Honor, to address Chief Justice, you're in court. How can we say this is plainly wrong? Because the record shows that Detective Montalvo's basis for his opinion is meritless. It's contradictory to the evidence that was presented.
But that goes to the weight of his opinion. And you're asking us to re-evaluate that.
And, Your Honor, I would pose the same argument I made to Justice Lemons, that where do you draw the line between appellate review, rubber stamping a trial court that has an expert opinion, or taking a closer look as a reviewing court as to the basis of that opinion? For example, hypothetically, Chief Justice, if you had a record in front of you and a vice narcotics detective says, this one dime bag and the fact that the appellant was nervous when I stopped him gives me the basis that he possessed it with the intent to distribute. And that's it. Would this court simply say, well, he opined by it. We have this very difficult standard of review for the appellant that it must be plainly wrong. I submit that that's not the standard in this case. And there must be some sort of clarification as opposed to simply accepting this opinion when he explains it on direct examination. It doesn't make any sense. And even his own opinion, he states, it's not unheard of for a user to get an 8-ball and use it, and then the amount that we have, the one package that we have, is 2.7.
I understand your position.
And again, it's a narrow issue. I don't anticipate I'll use all of my time in this case. But I want to emphasize a few points. It is a circumstantial case. All circumstances must be consistent with guilt and inconsistent with innocence. And that does not shift the burden to the defendant to testify in a drug distribution case where the constructive possession, as in this case may be an issue, to take the stand and say, I'm a drug user. It doesn't shift the burden to him. It doesn't shift the burden to him to explain, this is why I had two cell phones, or this is why money's stuffed in my pocket and I don't have a wallet. Too many individuals who use drugs are being convicted of possession with the intent to distribute because vice narcotic cops are running, police officers are running into court and opining that it's inconsistent with personal use and then simply sitting down after that. And I know the standard I'm up against, Your Honor, but I urge this court to remand the case back to the trial court for Mr. Harris to be sentenced for possession of cocaine. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Good morning, may it please the court, Robert Anderson for the Commonwealth. Without needlessly repeating some of the arguments I've made on brief, in all candor, I don't have a whole lot to add to what I've said there, but let me hopefully add a few points of at least some use value to the court. There are really three different ways to consider what's the ultimate issue before the court today, but under any of them, we should prevail. One is whether or not the judgment of the lower court was plainly wrong or without supporting evidence. Two, same test, whether the finding of fact of intent, which under case law is a finding of fact, was plainly wrong or without supporting evidence. And three, whether a reasonable jurist, or any reasonable jurist, not any and all, but just any reasonable jurist could find the evidence sufficient, and I submit that the evidence passes under any of those three formulations of the test before this court. First, counsel talks about that the trial court was just rubber stamping the investigator Montalvo's expert testimony, he never made any such contention in his closing argument. He never made it on brief. It's interesting, after investigator Montalvo gave his expert testimony, the cross-examination hardly challenged much of anything except brought up what clearly is the best fact that the defendant has going for him in the entire appeal, which is that there wasn't a substantial amount of cocaine recovered. It did little beyond that. There was no defense evidence put on, much less competing expert testimony. The closing argument of the defense, which is basically two pages, talks about, again, it doesn't do justice to the investigator's expert testimony and the reasons for his conclusion. Keeps saying, both there and on brief, refers to Montalvo's testimony, this is at page 82, the fact that he had two cell phones. Well, as Justice Lemon's question indicates, it goes well beyond simply the fact of two cell phones. It's two very dissimilar cell phones who, in this expert's experience and expertise and training, was indicative of drug dealing for the reasons he explained. So it's not merely the fact that there were two cell phones. The closing argument of the defense said not a word about the two cell phones and investigator Montalvo's testimony regarding the significance of those two dissimilar cell phones. I'm glad to see that counsel today has corrected his misstatement in his brief. He said near the end of his argument, referring to investigator Montalvo's testimony, this was on cross-examination. This is pointed out on brief, and I thought that this was certainly something that should be addressed. In connection with counsel's brief, cross-examination, again, regarding primarily the fact that there weren't a lot of, the amount of cocaine was not substantial. The question was, page 79, so this is not an unusual amount for a user to have. Answer, it is heard of for users to buy an 8-ball, which is 3.5 grams, and to use it over an extended period of time, end quote. Somehow that answer at trial became on brief that his testimony was that this typically was the case. And both as a matter of English and as a matter of fact, I'm the appellee and the evidence is viewed in the light most favorable to me, that just simply won't fly. For example, if the answer had been, it is not unheard of for users, and then gives the answer. Well, that would plainly indicate, well, I've heard about it and it might happen from time to time. It's hardly the norm. Well, this is effectively the same. I also point out again in terms of the principle on appeal that the evidence is viewed in the light most favorable to the appellee. You've had death penalty cases where during voir dire there was an answer, I think one or two of them where the answer was, I think so. And this court pointed out, I think so, depending on the inflection, could be said in any number of several ways, and the court adopted the characterization of that in a way that would support or was most favorable to the appellee, not the reverse. So that answer, that characterization of that answer simply, I think, is misplaced. And counsel also, page 8 of his brief, in a paragraph that is basically challenging the evidence, says, based on the small quantity of cocaine, the trial court began with an inference that the cocaine was for personal use. Next sentence. Detective Montalvo also opined that the amount recovered was consistent with personal use. That is inexplicable. That's precisely the opposite of what he said. And, I mean, I normally...
It's not the opposite of what he said. He said it's not unheard of.
No, but his expert conclusion... It's the opposite, where he said, in my view, this is page 70, have you formed an expert opinion about whether the cocaine in this case is consistent or inconsistent with personal use? Answer, I would say it was inconsistent with personal use. I take that to be just 180 degrees different. In any event, his testimony, he said what he said at trial, and totally apart from whether counsel is accurately or not so accurately referred to his testimony. Question, really, the controlling dispositive question is whether a reasonable jurist could consider this testimony and conclude from it that the intent to distribute was adequately proven. I might point out, by the way, that I think it's fair to say that Investigator Montalvo probably, the primary basis for his conclusion was the two dissimilar cell phones. And this is not something that just came to him. And counsel talked about, at the very end of his argument, apparently these investigators are chomping at the bit to run into court so they can give their expert testimony, which I think is an argument that an appellant can't really feasibly make on appeal. But the main point is other courts, and I've cited it on brief, have considered as probative of the defendant's intent the fact he was found with multiple cell phones. Again, here it's not merely multiple cell phones. It's dissimilar cell phones serving separate functions. I could go on. I, at some point, would mostly begin to repeat the arguments that I made on brief. Let me make two final points. Beyond the expert's testimony, there were other circumstances, one of which the trial, in fact, didn't elaborate on the basis for the conviction as a bench trial. The Commonwealth Attorney's closing argument pointed out, as per case law, that there was no evidence this defendant was a user, so that tended to support the conclusion, the inference of the requisite intent. Also, the case law indicates that the lack of proof of ingestion devices or other things for personal use is probative. Again, that goes into the mix. And finally, both on brief and today, counsel's talked about, well, it's not that unusual to have two cell phones, putting aside whether they're dissimilar, and there might be any number of explanations and reasons for that. And I would point out that this court in the Commonwealth v. Hudson case, which is cited on brief, basically says the time for the defendant to offer explanations of innocence is at trial and on appeal. He can't offer the kinds of explanations he's offering today. So I would ask the court to affirm, and unless there are any other questions, I would sit down.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal.
Your Honor, the Commonwealth, in its argument, is shifting the burden to a defendant to present evidence and explain. And that's what it's urging this court to affirm the conviction on. And that is just plainly wrong.
You're talking about his reference to evidence that's consistent with innocence as opposed to guilt.
Yes, sir.
Well, his reference to the Hudson case, in the Hudson case, we said that that concept was simply another way of saying that the burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt and it's on the Commonwealth. So he did make reference to that, but he made reference to it in the context of a case that makes it clear that the burden of proof is still on the Commonwealth and not on your client.
I would be remiss if I didn't make the point. I'll move on, Your Honor. Two points, Detective Montalvo. Two phones that are dissimilar. I would submit to this court, any individual that, or most individuals that walk into 7-Eleven, buy a prepaid disposable phone, they just as likely have a nicer phone. It doesn't prove anything. And that was the crux of Detective Montalvo's opinion, even by the Commonwealth. And then we get back to...
Well, you're leaving out of that, and you've got marijuana and cocaine on your person or on the console of the car. So that affects how that's viewed.
Correct. And I'm struggling, Your Honor, because I want to make arguments that's just not in the record of how individuals can ingest crack cocaine with marijuana without any sort of ingestion device needed. And it's common for marijuana cigarettes or blunts, as they put it, to be laced. But that was never brought up in the record. But at the same time, I want to address Your Honor's inquiry. I would submit to the court, and I'm running out of time, that the fact that the marijuana is there is just as likely that this individual was a drug abuser, a poly-substance abuser.
Thank you. Your time is up. The court will take a short recess.